So you made the change from being primarily a clinician to primarily a researcher, and I believe it started with your research with Lou Nashner. Did you meet Marjorie Woollacott shortly after that, or how did that relationship begin?
I actually met Marjorie in Lou's lab. So Marjorie, and she wasn't actually, well, she was working with Lou, but she was a postdoc in working with a scientist who was at the Neurological Sciences Institute where Lou was. And so we met while I came to work with Lou, and Marjorie was just finishing up her postdoc. And we, as you often do with people, there's some people that you just click with. Mm-hmm. And I knew, we knew right away that we were going to be friends. The very first day, I'll tell you just a funny story. The very first day I met her, we decided to go out to lunch together. And so we walked outside and we were going to get into her car. And she opened up the trunk of her car to put something in it. And there was the book, Edna St. Vincent Millay's poetry book, which is happens to be one of my favorite poet. Mm-hmm. And she and I looked at I looked at her and I said, do you like Ed? Oh, she said, my favorite poetress is Edna St. Vincent Millay. And my favorite poem within that is, of course, her very famous Millennium poem. And it was like, in that moment, we sort of looked at one another and thought, wow. And then we started collaborating together and became friends, of course, ever since. So
did you have any major, I want to say theological differences, but that's probably not the right word. Did you have any times that you felt that your collaborative processes should go in a different direction, or that you had differences in opinion about something you were investigating?
Well, I've collaborated with a lot of people over time, and mm-hmm. there have been a lot of disagreements during that course of time. Not so much about, it has much more to do with interpretation of mm-hmm. information, how one interprets information, and whether it's in a research project or in a particular patient. There are disagreements about how one interprets information, and that's a difficult thing to work out. Mm-hmm. It is, whether it's, it just is a difficult. So I'm fortunate that I've collaborated with a lot of different people, and I've been able to sort of follow my own course as far as what my interests have been.
I have just curious about, when you think back on your career, what's a moment or a few moments that just kind of make you smile?
There are several moments. I know one very, very memorable moment that I had. One was actually attending my very first APTA meeting, which was when I was a PT student. And walking in, I can't even remember where the meeting was, and realizing, my God, this is a much bigger profession than I thought. Dang, there's people here from all over the United States. It was like I suddenly had a sense of, and that sense was a sense of joy about, wow, there's a lot of people that are really interested in the same things I mm-hmm. am. And the same thing happened to me, the same aha, when I went to my first World Congress meeting. And then it was like, holy smokes, it's not only in the United States, it's all over the world. And that still happens to me. So I'm doing a lot of teaching overseas now. And what I've realized is that PTs are PTs worldwide. There is something really amazing about this organization of people. They are. So that's one, is the sense of connectedness I feel and felt with this profession. And there were specific moments in my career when I really felt that connection. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, and it's not just one, there were two particular patients in particular that I remember feeling this. And when a patient said to me, when we started working together, and she looked at me, she happened to be an older woman, and she said, you know, you have given me so much hope that I can be better than I am. And I remember thinking that in that moment, I have more to offer my patients than just a good exercise program. I might be actually giving them a lot more than just that. And that's actually been echoed by quite a few patients. And I don't underestimate the importance of that.
And and therein is an interesting point of how I see you kind of shifting in these past few years in your career. And that's one, I think one of the universal things about physical therapists, they bring hope to people, which is hard to support with evidence. It's like I say to my residents sometimes, we're physical therapists. And I think that therapy part, the things that you've been talking about the other factors that affect outcome, how are we going to incorporate that into kind of the future of physical therapy and maybe that into where do you see our profession going from this point?
Well, I will play a little devil's advocate here, Kathy.
Okay.
So it is true that I believe that there are many things that I bring to a therapy situation. But if I can't change physical function, that's what I'm being paid to do. And so I think that it is important to realize that if all I did was just give that patient hope but didn't change their function, then I haven't done my job.
Correct. So that's the physical part where the science evidence comes in.
Exactly. And so that's where the issue of... That's why I actually love the APTA's, whatever that little saying is, the science of healing and the art of caring. I believe absolutely perfectly captures our profession. And I say that to my students all the time. Art of caring is an essential component of what we do, but the science of healing is equally important. So you can be as compassionate as you want, but if you are not skilled at what you do, you're not going to get the outcome. On the other hand, skill without compassion is a bitter pill to swallow. So I believe that both are necessary, and we need to be training and doing more to help both students and therapists value both.
That's really excellent. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to go a little bit, because my personal interest in is vestibular rehabilitation, and you've dabbled in a lot of different areas, but what brought you to vestibular rehab?
Again, it was a collaboration. I knew nothing about vestibular rehab, nothing. And when I went to Lou's lab to work, I met Owen Black, who is a neuro-otologist. Mm-hmm. And Owen came to Lou's lab in order to look at the effect of vestibular dysfunction on posture control. And at the time, there was some vestibular treatment going on in Europe, but virtually nothing,
right,
really, in this country.
Yeah, because that was back in the late 80s.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And Owen believed that exercise could, in fact, make his patients better. And so he said, I want to start sending you patients, Anne. I had never seen vestibular patients. And it was like, okay, well, send them. I'll try and figure it out as I go. And so he started referring patients, and we started evaluating patients and then trying different types of therapies and reading the literature to see what existed and having success and beginning to try to formulate a sort of a comprehensive approach to managing patients' symptoms in patients with different types of vestibular problems. And so it really just evolved that way. And then once we began to have success and we started doing, we decided to try and formalize it and teach it a little bit to other therapists so that they would know. And so then Faye and I started teaching courses in the beginning. But really, it was, however, I will have to say, once I started working with the neurotology for the vestibular patients, I was actually, my primary practice was traumatic brain injury. Mm-hmm. So young adults with traumatic brain injury. And I suddenly realized the percentage of my patients who were, in fact, presenting with symptoms that were very reminiscent of the vestibular problems. And so I suddenly realized the absolute relevance of what I was doing in those patients. And then the expansion to that, realizing that it's applicable to geriatrics and all kinds of things. So, yeah. But that's how it got started, is through my collaboration with Owen Black.
So what types of tests and measures were you using for the patients at that time?
There were none.
Develop?
We developed. I mean, that's how the dynamic gait index, for example, got formed, is because I realized that just doing a simple, usual pace gait wasn't... most of my patients could do that had even significant vestibular problems. And it was like, this isn't going to work. And then, but yet, if they turned to look at somebody coming out, they were like all over staggering. Mm-hmm. And suddenly I thought, maybe in addition to ask them to walk a straight line, I might ask them to walk and turn their head from side to side. It was like, wow, look at the people who are unsteady. And then it was like, well, patients with benign paroxysmal positional vertigo have problems in vertical canals. Mm-hmm. And so maybe I should ask them also to look up and down. Ooh, that made some people unsteady. So the dynamic gait index emerged from observation of the conditions under which patients have problems and then codifying that and standardizing it. So we created, the same is true for the CATSIP test, recognizing that many patients were complaining of imbalance under contexts and conditions in which sensory information was altered, and yet we had no current test for that. And so then thinking about how we might standardize an approach. So most of the things that I have created have come from clinical observations of patients and the conditions under which. So I'm a big proponent of observation.
Just like Rood and Golbath and Brunstrom, see?
So I remember the days when we did put the dome over the head. What was that? The Chinese lantern over the head. There's one still under a mat somewhere. So did your work there influence Lou Nashner in terms of developing the AquaTest?
Actually, Lou influenced us. It's the other way around. So Lou had developed not the AquaTest, but the laboratory version of the AquaTest. And so for his research at MIT, looking at the effect of, looking at the role of the vestibular system in stance posture control. And so Lou and I used to joke all the time about the fact that he is has his PhD, a doctorate in science, from MIT. He's a high-tech person. You're talking to a low-tech person. You're talking about the lowest-tech person you will ever meet is probably me. I barely manage my iPhone, which was just forced on me. So I am a low-tech person. So I came out with the foam and dome because it was the low-tech version of this very sophisticated high-tech piece of equipment. So that seems to be sort of a hallmark of who I am, is a generation of a low-tech version of things, because that suits who I am.
Well, it's part of that research to clinic.
Well, but even more than that, it's part of therapist preference. So there are therapists who have a preference, just like our patients do. There are some patients who are into gadgets and they love gadgets. Mm-hmm. You put them on a balance master and they just love that stuff. And there are other patients who are not gadget oriented. Mm-hmm. And then putting them on a balance master is not the right thing to do. So I think we have to be less driven by the equipment and more driven by patient preference and understanding things like that. So, yes.
Was the dynamic visual acuity test around then?
No.
No?
I mean, it was as a strictly laboratory test. Okay. I mean, like the VOR.
Right.
But was there a clinical version of that? And the answer is no.
No.
So those things were developed as more and more clinicians learned that they needed to know the information, didn't have the sophisticated equipment to develop it. And so that whole thing, what is it? Necessity is the mother of invention, what happens. And so that's a part of the iterative process of the development of the field.
So this is kind of, I think sometimes we like to rub each other just to get a little bit of discussion going. But so I think this is very interesting what you just said at that point. So you started with high-tech equipment to create these quantification of very important information that we learned about the nervous system. So they're kind of principles, if you will, that are supported now in this evidence. And then they get translated into something that's ecologically valid in the clinic so this therapist can, you know, translate that information and do it wherever they are in the world.
But I think that the key here is the issue of the relevance of that information to guide my practice. So that may be, I don't integrate something has to be significantly important in clinical decision making for me to integrate it. So why would I include the foam and dome, for example, in my clinical evaluation? Is the recognition that the patient's behavior in that test dictates some aspect of my treatment. And that's what, for me, becomes the acid test for whether or not I'm going to move something from a research, which is a largely theoretical question about how the nervous system works, into my clinical practice, which is, do I need this information to make informed decisions about how to best treat my patient? If it didn't, then it's not likely to make its way into my practice.
And that, I think, is where a little bit of my concern today is in the clinical trials that are looking at how we test effectiveness of interventions, I think is really problematic. And maybe you could speak to this, is what is the value of rehabilitation clinical trials, and what is the cautionary tale of rehabilitation clinical trials, of where we are now?
I think my response would be, clinical trials are never going to give us all the information we need to make decisions about how to treat patients. And so that's my feeling, is that, and I am always fond of quoting that paper by Mant from Lancet, the journal Lancet, where he said, RCTs or clinical trials are the best way to determine whether an intervention is effective, but arguably the worst way to determine who will benefit. And so, as a clinician, I need to know, is this intervention effective, at least at a population level? But as a clinician, I'm sitting across from a specific patient, and I need to know what is the best intervention for that particular patient, given that particular patient's constellation of problems and issues. And so, RCTs, I think, provide essential information to us, but they are not going to be able to provide all the information that we need to make informed decisions as clinicians.
I have a final question. What are you looking forward to observing in the profession in the next number of years? What do you see on the horizon that you think was exciting or...
Probably, in terms of neuro rehab, I think an expansion and better understanding of activity-dependent neuroplasticity. Trying to understand, truly understand, the factors that we need to know that are driving neuro or activity-dependent neuroplasticity and then optimizing function at the same time. So I think we are beginning to get hints about certain things, but there's so much we don't know in order to translate that that information into guidelines for practice. So there's still this enormous gulf, and I'm hoping and looking forward to the research that's going to come that's going to help us sort some of those issues out, the relative importance of intensity, repetition or context or some of these other factors. I think that we're still too far away from having the specific understanding of how to apply to an individual patient, and that's the area I'm looking forward to most.
You've done quite a bit of lecturing, and especially internationally now, and I was looking through your resume and saw that you did a lecture in Limerick, Ireland on patient compliance in home exercise programs. No, I missed that lecture. So what do you have as advice for those who have patients that have challenges in this area?
Well, since I just gave that talk.
Okay. Another benefit of CSM. Yes.
I just finished that talk. I think that that we need to pay as much attention in our research paradigms to understanding factors that influence adherence and how complex those factors are. So we spend so much time looking at which intervention is more effective or less effective or comparably effective to other interventions without spending sufficient time understanding the factors that will determine whether the patient actually does the intervention. And so I think that that is something that we really need to address, particularly because the research shows that even the best interventions, adherence rates are less than 50%. So in PT. And so it's like we need to spend equal time to understanding the factors that determine whether a patient will in fact adopt or adhere to an exercise program or a therapeutic program, regardless of what it is. In terms of what are some of those factors, I think that probably what I'm beginning to realize is just how complex those factors are. That they go well beyond the, there are many complex factors within the individual: age, socioeconomics, education level, income level, disease severity, all kinds of things. Patients' perceptions to a large extent will drive whether or not they'll even show up at your door for physical therapy, let alone stay in your door and continue or continue with a program afterwards. So things like their perceptions regarding their capacity to do the program, self-efficacy, their expectations regarding whether or not they're going to, the program itself will causally link to the outcomes they want, which is outcomes expectation, and barriers. The barriers seem to be much more important than motivators in determining whether a patient will adhere. But there are also other factors, contextual factors, that have an enormous impact that we are not taking into consideration that affect adherence to exercise or therapeutic activities. We often think about the environment, for example, and we as therapists often look at the environment to see how it supports function. So does the patient have grab bars in the bathroom? Does it, you know, those kinds of things. So we're looking at the built environment relative to supporting functional independence, but we don't look at the environment to say, how will this environment support or be a barrier to the patient's ability to carry out the program I want them to do at home? And given the fact that we know practice and repetition is critical to improvements in function, making sure that the environment supports the program that we want the patient to do is going to be a very important part. And I think we know very little about factors that influence adherence and the complexity and interaction. So one last comment related to that. There's emerging research also to show that the factors that determine adherence early on to a program are not the factors that determine long-term adherence to a program, and so we need to be aware of that. We're not teaching patients to do therapeutic activities for a period of 4 weeks or 6 weeks or 12 weeks. We're teaching them to do exercises and activities for life, and so we need to be thinking in terms of what factors impact. So if I were staying in the profession in terms of research, one of the big areas I probably would move into is actually adherence and factors that influence adherence. And so,
well, and you know, I think that that is a very important point, and it has to do with like finding what is that factor that that is meaningful to the patient. And one of the things that I think I'm starting to realize is the absolute tremendous impact that a person with a disability has on the people in their family. And that sometimes is the motivator. And I think we're looking so, we're like looking at the person, this patient, quote unquote, but finding out how we can make their life easier in their reality,
context,
I think is just so critical.
So you've been a member of the APTA since you were a student, right? And you've remained a member. Retention's not an issue with you. What could you say to someone the importance about being a member of the professional association?
On many levels, I believe it's important. And I do believe that it is important for all of us to belong to the professional organization. I think for a starter, it helps us understand that we are, in fact, a community of people that are united in a common goal. And it's good to be reminded of that. When we're alone practicing in our clinics or our individual practice, you can feel somewhat isolated. And it's important to step back and remember that you are actually part of a larger community. And that community can support you and help you if you will let it. And joining the APTA has, at least for me, done that. And so I believe that. It's also a source of continuing education and lifelong learning. So it's, you can try to do this on your own by reading journals and things like that, but nothing replaces coming face to face and talking to people and sharing ideas and exchanging information and rubbing up against people that don't necessarily agree with and exchanging ideas and broadening your perspective. And I think Jonathan Haidt, who is an author of the book Happiness Hypothesis, one of the things he said, I just heard an interview and I really thought about it. He said, look, we don't learn to broaden our opinions in isolation, nor do we learn to broaden our opinions by hanging out with people who think just like us.
That's so true.
The only way we broaden our opinions and move forward is when we interact with one another, particularly the one another's that don't necessarily see the way we do, providing we approach it with a feeling of mutual respect and appreciation. And so I think it's very important that we come together as an organization and have an opportunity to exchange ideas and disagreements and still walk away and have a glass of wine together.
That's right.
Can you think of a time you came to a meeting and walked away with a new idea or direction?
I can't think of a meeting where that hasn't happened. So there you go. I've never been to I haven't missed a CSM in probably 30 years. And I've always come away with a bazillion ideas, both clinical, for clinical practice as well as research.
Excellent. You were also the first co-president of the Balance and Fall SIG.
I was.
Okay, how did they rope you into that?
Oh my God, I have no clue.
I believe
it was you.
No, you tell you how you got us started, and I'll remember the first thing you did to me in a direct conversation after I became president was linked to the SIG.
I'll remind you.
It's
one of those things that I have a passion for. I had a passion for, obviously, Balance and Falls, and I didn't feel that it was being adequately addressed in any of the sections. And so when they came to me with the idea of the joint Balance and Falls SIG between geriatrics and neuro, I was more than willing to do it because I felt strongly that we as a profession, but the organization itself, was not addressing this very, very relevant issue that actually cuts across all sections, and I still feel that way. So when I'm passionate enough about something, you will engage me. You will get me to commit to something when I feel this very strong passion.
And I'm going to now tell a couple Anne Chumley Cook stories. Yes, because it has to be, these are true stories. So she did start this joint Balance and Falls geriatric section and neurology section SIG. And from the level of trying to manage the sections, it was a disaster. We never could make it work out. And so it ended up that they decided to dissolve the jointness of the two management sides of it, and then neurology section said, oh, we'll just drop it. She did not like that. And I came to my first CSM as president of the neurology section, and she comes right up to me and says, puts her finger in my face, and she said, we need to have this here. And I'm like, okay, help me understand. And she did, because when she's passionate about something, you know it. Okay. My other Anne story is we were in Alabama. This is actually the first time I had a personal conversation with her. Of course, I knew her. She was a hero to me. And we're at the Taub. The Taub conference, and it was a 40 individuals invited to think about paradigm shift in neurorehabilitation. And there was a person giving a lecture, and Anne didn't agree with him. And she's sitting behind me, and she starts poking me in the shoulder and saying, say something, because that had something with motor learning.
Did you know Anne at this time?
No. And she's poking me in the shoulder, and I look over my shoulder. I'm like, me? You're Anne Chumley Cook. and it was like, I was just like shocked. She was poking me, and it was her. And so we get through this discussion in the lecture, and we go out in the hall, and I'm like, hi, I've never met you. I'm Kathy Sullivan. And she's like, I know. And I'm like, but at that's when we became friends. Because
I poked her in the shoulder.
Right.
And said, speak up. Speak up. By God, had I known you were going to speak up, I'd have duct taped you years ago, girl.
But just kidding.
I know. Edit that out. But Anne is definitely one of those people who gets you going, gets you thinking, pokes you in the shoulder and says, hey, kid, what you doing? Makes you speak up.
I believe it.
I will always appreciate that.
Thanks.
From you. And you you're one of those people that we don't always think the same, and that's why we help each other stretch.
Exactly. But, I think that's critical.
I do too.
Believe Jonathan Haidt's thing of, you never grow by staying in your own little silo. That's mm-hmm. why I'm putting a plug in. I heard recently, I don't know if this is true or not, we can edit this out, that combined sections meeting is getting so large, they're thinking about splitting it up. And I vote no. Allow me a moment to explain why. I believe that cross-fertilization is critical to our mm-hmm. profession. Mm-hmm. It is critical. And we need to develop the skills to continue to have combined sections meeting with all the sections so there can be cross-fertilization. Mm-hmm. So we do not stay in our little silos. It is critical to us as a profession that we stay together and move ahead so that we have joint programming and things like that. Whoever's listening.
Well, I recall going to a lecture of yours at Combined Sections Meeting, and you were referring to all these other researchers around the world. And I think that was really important to me to not be so USA-centric and to realize the value that other professionals, not just PTs, but other countries, therapists in other countries bring to the table. And I remember specifically you talking about an anti-injury device with Fallers that was a piece of clothing that blew up. Were they like the balloon pants?
Yes.
And that you actually confessed that you had worn them mm-hmm. and had eliminated them as a possible treatment device because of the aesthetic of them, shall I say. Yes, and I really remember that vividly laughing. And I thought, at that point, Dr. Shumway Cook is really approachable if she's able to say things like that.
That's because no woman will willingly pad their hips.
make them bigger.
It's like those hip pads were developed by men. Sorry for the gender bias, but and no woman will willingly pad their hips. I don't care if it's to prevent hip fracture or not. So, mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I heard a rumor that you were retired. So, what's your approach to retirement?
I am, in fact, partially retired, and mm-hmm. my approach to retirement is to say yes to all the things I feel passionately about and no to everything else. So there it is in a nutshell. So if I feel strongly about something, I will continue to do it. And when I stop feeling strongly about it, I will stop doing and say no. So that's the joy of retirement to me, is that things are more under my control in terms of saying. So I actually have a quote from Basho, a Japanese poet, that I posted right on retirement that said, pass by that which you do not love. And I decided that was my affirmation in retirement. And so mm-hmm. I pass by that which I do not love. And if I love it, then I engage in it. And if I don't, I pass it by.
So what's your passion right now?
I have multiple things that I'm passionate about. So the profession remains a passion for me in many different forms. And so I will remain engaged in the profession for a little while longer, at least. I have other passions as well, obviously. My family, I'm a grandmother now with grandchildren, and I'm a quilter, and I have a passion for that. I have a passion for comparative religious studies, and I'm doing a lot of that. And so the nice thing about retirement is that it has allowed me to follow some of the other passions I have, and I'm enjoying that.
When you came in this afternoon and we were talking about the interview today, you pulled out several pages of things notes. That you wanted, notes that you had prepared for the interview. So I wanted to give you this opportunity to make sure that we had allowed you to address the things that you wanted to let the therapist listening to this interview.
I don't think so. I think that some of the changes, you asked me to contemplate the changes in our profession over the last 40 years, and there have been a lot. There have been a lot of changes, and some I absolutely agree with, and some actually I don't agree with so much. But things like the shift that I do agree with is the shift from prescription to autonomous practice. And so when I graduated from PT school, not only did mm-hmm. we have to have physician referral, that physician wrote a detailed prescription. Mm-hmm. You will do ultrasound mm-hmm. for this many minutes at this, remember that?
Yes.
And you're going to do exercise, and you'll do quadricep strengthening, you'll do 20 reps, and it was mm-hmm. very prescribed. And then we did finally go to physician referral, evaluate and treat as you see fit. And now we're moving to autonomous practice. And so that's been a significant change. There's also been a significant change in the way we reimburse and things like that. Mm-hmm. So, I think that we pretty much covered the things that I thought were fun to think about, all the way from the mundane of shifts in uniform to critical what I feel are very important factors, such as where we draw our evidence for to justify our practice. So.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so
and
much.
And I appreciate you taking time out from your very busy schedule this CSM to join us and allow us to capture your thoughts for the future.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening to our interview with Anne Shumway Cook. I hope you will share this podcast with interested friends and colleagues, and stay tuned for our next Conversation with an Inspiration.